You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. 11 lectures translated by Christian von Arnim. This is the 10th lecture, given in Dornach on the 9th of October, 1915. Using Wrangel's pamphlet on title Science and Theosophy, we have attempted to discuss various thoughts which show how someone who wants to stand completely firmly on the ground of modern science is, nevertheless, impelled toward the acknowledgement that there can be cognition of the spiritual life. And as you have seen, we did not so much have to object to Wrangel's pamphlet as to supplement it along the lines of spiritual science. In this brochure, therefore, there is what at first appears to be a subjective judgment on the path of the modern scientist toward spiritual science. How, in other words, you can perfectly well be a modern scientist and still find the path to spiritual science. It is important to consider this line of thought in particular, because it seems to me quite necessary that those who stand on the ground of spiritual science should clearly recognize that the objections of the so-called scientists are not really scientific at all, but come from the fact that today a person can be an excellent scientist who knows how to handle the materialistic scientific methods in a given field of science quite well, but can at the same time be a dilettante in all other questions regarding views of the world. Now today, in continuation, so to speak, of the thoughts developed on the basis of the pamphlet, I would like to go on to develop a number of other thoughts of importance for us. I would like to show how the present development of humanity has reached a point which should suggest to the insightful scientist, to someone who really takes science seriously and knows how to appreciate it, that they should engage in the study of spiritual science and not do it in the way that has been preferred up to now, to regard it as something to be rejected from the outset. As some of you will remember, I have in some respects sung the praises of the materialistic scientific method in the reflections that were built on Wrangel's pamphlet. I said that it produced great and significant results in recent times, that we need only adopt a proper point of view toward this materialistic scientific method, and we would appreciate and not underestimate it. We will familiarize ourselves with its results particularly if we intend to draw the connecting threads between it and spiritual science, as needs to be done. Now, I would first like to start from what is to a certain extent a natural scientific line of reasoning, which can show us how the thinking natural scientist, especially when they understand themselves in the right way, should knock on the door of spiritual science. I would like to draw attention to a chapter of modern natural science which is also of great importance in social and ethical terms, but which cannot attain this in a way that is satisfactory for human beings as long as natural science has not found its way to spiritual science. I would like to elaborate a little on some lines of reasoning in what is called criminal anthropology. One of the great researchers in criminal anthropology is Professor Dr. Moritz Benedict, whom I have already mentioned several times. He was one of the first to examine criminal brains in a very modern, systematic way by subsequently dissecting criminals, especially murderers, who had been sentenced to death. The results were indeed so surprising, compared to many of the previous views, that at first, after the initial investigations, he might have thought he was dealing with a kind of scientific adventure and not at all with anything on the trail of truth. So when he examined criminal brains, they always showed, that is, for those familiar with the configuration, with the plasticity of the normal human brain, very specific internal structures, with very specific features, that differed from the structure of the brain of a person who was not a criminal. And so that we don't spread ourselves too widely, I want to stick to the main characteristic. It turned out that a certain part of the human brain, called the occipital lobe, which covers the cerebellum, is too small in criminals, so that it only barely covers the cerebellum, or does not cover at all, which it otherwise covers completely. Now imagine that you dissect a criminal brain and find that this criminal brain differs from a normal brain in such a way that the occipital lobe does not completely cover the cerebellum. Then you must come to the conclusion, if someone is born in such a way that it is impossible to develop the occipital lobe to such an extent that it covers the cerebellum, then no matter what they do in life, they simply become a criminal, and consequently they can't help it. And if you now examine monkey brains, you will see the same peculiarity. The occipital lobe does not completely cover the cerebellum. So that we have to say, in the various moments of evolution, on the way from monkey to human, it must also be noted that the human being has progressed beyond monkey evolution, and has become a more perfect being in that their occipital lobe has grown and completely covers the cerebellum. This means that when a person becomes a criminal, they revert to the monkey organization. In the case of the criminal, then, we are dealing with distinct atavism. This means nothing other than that there are individuals walking around among human beings who have atavistically reverted to the monkey image in their brain structure. These atavistic individuals simply become criminals. Now think of the ethical and social consequences of such a view, and then you will know what it means under the conditions of the present materialistic worldview. I do not mean the prevailing natural science, to have to submit to these facts. For the facts exist, and only a fool could deny them. Thus the person who is guided by the materialistic worldview is faced with the challenge. Just look at the brains of criminals. You can see that the brain structure reverts to monkey-like. So you see clearly how that which reveals itself morally in the human being is simply a consequence of the material organization of the body. You can see it clearly there. The person who had this brain became a criminal precisely because he had this brain. With the same necessity with which the clockwork serves us when it works correctly so that we can catch the train at 10 o'clock, while a clockwork that goes wrong and perhaps only shows 7 o'clock makes us late for the train, with the same necessity, a brain that has not managed the full formation of the occipital lobe indicates a criminal person who has remained behind. As you will probably choose not to fantasize a demon into the clock that drives the hands around, you will also choose not to magic the soul demon into the brain. If we were to resist the proven results of criminal anthropological investigations of criminal brains, without further ado, this would mean practicing ostrich politics in science. It would simply mean not wanting to reckon with those things that have been fully investigated. Now, as you know, apart from materialistic science, there is also philosophy. But if you look at this philosophy, perhaps especially among those who are often counted among its most important representatives today, you will find that this philosophy is completely powerless in the face of materialistic methods. The concepts that philosophers obtain either amount to saying, as I have shown you with Otto Liebmann, who is a very perceptive man and who says that one cannot get beyond certain points, that one cannot go beyond certain limits. I gave you the example of the hen's egg. Or if you take the philosophy of Rudolf Eucken and Jena, who can see how they bandy words around and fudge them beautifully, but how the concepts that are developed there cannot come close to the materialistic methods. These are like the actions of a man who stands here on one bank of the river and makes all kinds of efforts to cross over to the other bank, but cannot get across. On the other side is the materialistic scientific method, but he cannot get across. So philosophizing remains just waffle. What is actually going on there? Well, let us go back to something we have known for a long time. Let us go back to the division of the human being into physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, capital. Let us take this crudest division to begin with, as it has presented itself to us in the course of our spiritual scientific investigations, and ask ourselves, what happens when you look at something outwardly sensory, and a criminal brain is by all means also something outwardly sensory? What happens there? The outwardly sensory acts on our sense organs. They are in the physical body. That is where sensory perception arises. No one denies that. We would be fools to deny it as spiritual scientists. It would be obtuse if we did not deal with such results as I have cited from criminal anthropology. We must not deny their force either, because they certainly prove that the criminal walks around with a monkey brain and the normal human being no longer has this monkey brain. So when we philosophize, as today's philosophers do, what are we doing? In which regions of the human being do we then move? Then we move in the sphere of the I, capital. That is where all the philosophical concepts are today. And precisely among those who philosophize most astutely today, you will be able to see everywhere that they are as if we're just bobbing around in the region of the I. You can find scholarly proof of this in the introductory chapter of my title, Riddles of Philosophy, where I have shown how in our time philosophy tends essentially to be a bobbing about in the I. But between natural science and philosophy there is a wide gap. That is the river over which philosophy cannot cross. That is to say that we have the philosophical concepts on the one side, inwardly in the human being, and all external sensory perceptions on the other side. I once symptomatically, but only symptomatically, my dear friends, quite vividly had this abyss between philosophizing and natural scientific perception before me. But please note that this is only meant symptomatically. At the 60th birthday celebration of Ernst Haeckel. That's when I took part in the celebration in Jena. All kinds of people spoke there, followers of Haeckel and so on. Now it was interesting for me to learn what would emerge when Haeckel's philosophical colleagues, among whom was also Dr. Rudolf Eucken, gave a so-called toast during the lunch, as is so customary. For then it would have been possible to see in some way how the representatives of philosophy at a university relate to the representatives of natural science and sensory perception. The toast, it was given by Eucken, had approximately the following content. I only give the main thought. Eucken said something like, at a birthday celebration like today's, it is customary to have to say what particularly characterizes the birthday child. Now I tried to think what might particularly characterize our birthday child, but I found nothing in particular in my own thinking. I asked our celebrant's daughter, and she told me that it was one of our celebrant's characteristic peculiarities that he couldn't get to grips with his tie, for example, when he wanted to put it on. The toast continued in this vein. Well, as I said, I was symptomatically confronted with what the representatives of philosophy at a university had to say about the representatives of sensory scientific perceptions. It is really symptomatic because there is no real bridge between contemporary philosophy and natural science, because the concepts of the philosophers are quite meager, and the sensory facts that natural science brings to light are beyond its shore. You can't get across with the philosophical concepts. Now, I have already drawn to your attention that there is a way of bringing the facts of natural science into flux, properly into flux. This possibility consists in really engaging with the spirit of Goethe's scientific reflections. Remember that I have explained to you how Goethe came to regard the bones of the skull as transformed dorsal vertebra, even though their outer form is quite different from that of the vertebra. I drew your attention to this theory of transformation when I told you that our boiler house is only a transformation of our main building in that it is partly enlarged and partly atrophied. I also, in another lecture, drew to your attention that when you ascend from ordinary concepts to spiritual scientific concepts, You have to set the concepts in motion. I recommended in this respect reading Goethe's poems on the metamorphosis of plants and animals. There you will see how mobile the concepts are and how he has shaped it all. If you take what I have said on these various occasions, together with what we must be directed toward today, then you will say to yourself, if I take the sensory perceptions as such, they are more limited. But if I go over to the Goethean worldview, then such a dorsal vertebra appears to me in such a way that it is more elastic, softer, so that gradually it turns into a part of the skull. I look into creative nature in this way. I see, for example, how in fish the individual bones of the skull are very similar to the dorsal vertebra, and how then the development toward the human being occurs in that the dorsal vertebra develop into the bones of the skull. However, you can only follow this spiritually. You can't look at that with the senses. If you wanted to look at it with the senses, you would have to observe for thousands, millions of years, how one transforms into the other. So you have to spiritualize the observation, the sensory perception. You see, Goethe instinctively got this spiritualization of sensory perception right. I have often drawn attention to that meaningful conversation between him and Schiller, when on one occasion they were leaving the Natural History Society in Jena together after a lecture by the botanist Bach. Schiller said he had found everything in Bach just so unconnected. Goethe then drew his archetypal plant, which is what you get when you transition from one plant form to another. Then Schiller said, "But that is not an observation, that is an idea." And Goethe replied, "Then I have my ideas in front of my eyes." He was aware that he was not only seeing the individual transformations, but that he saw a plant in all parts of the plant. Underlying this is that Goethe instinctively observed everything in the way that you cannot just observe with the physical senses, but when you immediately capture the physical perception in the observation of the etheric body. That is to say, Goethe includes the metamorphosing perception, and this is a perpetually fluid perception in his view of nature. This sets the whole sensory world in motion for him. The individual part is then only a specific expression of something very general, but not so general as the abstract philosophers make it, but of something general that winds its way through the individual sensory perceptions. There you see sensory perception raised up into the imaginative sphere which arises in the human being when we do not disdain to add our etheric body to sensory perception. You cannot understand what Goethe wrote about animals and plants if you do not consider that he included the etheric body. Now you have already raised it a bit higher. We would now have accomplished something if we had still moved the philosophical concepts over here so that they could come close to the perceptions. Now, take what we have often considered over the years. This belongs to the first stage of what it says in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? That it is possible to raise physical, concrete perception to a higher level, to imaginative perception. But remember the characteristic I have stated over and over again. It is found in innumerable passages in our cycles, of which this imaginative perception consists. It consists of working back through the eye into the etheric body. As long as we only form concrete concepts, as the philosopher does as well, that they work in the spirit is merely a delusion of grandeur. We will not get any further. We must pass from concrete to imaginative cognition. That is to say, as soon as life enters into the concepts, we return from the I on its own back into the etheric body. We work on the astral body to become the spirit self. That is to say, we can say that philosophical concepts become imaginative concepts or conceptions, if we can still use the word concept here. But now, things have become unified. The imaginative concepts are no longer separated from the metamorphosing perceptions by a gulf, but are immediately adjoining. We shall now see that while philosophy and sense perception are separated by a gulf, and cannot come together because physical perception has its process in the physical body, and the philosopher has their process in the eye. Here, however, evidently something was drawn again on the board. The imaginative concepts and the perceptions come together because the concrete concept is in the physical body, and the metamorphosed concepts are in the etheric body. So it is a deepening in both directions. On the one hand, we must approach the world with the whole person. And on the other hand, we must deepen the concepts by bringing them to life, by turning them into imaginations. That is what the philosophers want to avoid. They cannot engage with the concept of imagination, and the natural scientist cannot engage with a grasp of metamorphosing perception. But this is brought about by spiritual science. Our whole spiritual science is actually an answer to the question, how does the rational human being, living in their astral body, perceive the perceptions living and metamorphosing in their etheric body? How do they think them? That is what is so important. That we really know that we are bringing the outer world closer to the inner world. That they are coming closer together. That we are bringing them together. Only now can we gain some perspective on what something like the reality of criminal anthropology is all about. Of course, a person who is born in such a way that their growth is such that the occipital lobe does not properly cover the cerebellum will walk around all their life with such a monkey-like occipital lobe. But where does such a monkey-like occipital lobe come from? The latter, in terms of spiritual science, is the consequence of the preceding life. For what the human being was in the past works from within on the development of their body. This is how they create the structure of their body and brain, and thus also their occipital lobe. So we can say, if a person walks around with a stunted occipital lobe, they have not acquired enough strength in their previous life to form the occipital lobe normally. This is no consolation, because there is always the possibility that such a person will become a criminal, because the occipital lobe cannot, after all, be enlarged. We could now say, people are then divided into two groups, into those who have too small an occipital lobe and are born criminals, and into those who have a fully developed occipital lobe and do not become criminals. For the materialistic worldview, there is little to argue here. That is the conclusion it will reach. For spiritual science, there is, theoretically, no other answer either. But since it knows that the physical body is not the only body, but also carries an etheric body within itself, the situation changes for it. Because if a person is born with a stunted occipital lobe, that is, with an unfavorable disposition, then we can still educate that person properly. We can structure education in such a way that we teach them appropriate moral and ethical concepts. This means that although the physical body cannot be changed in the present incarnation, the etheric part of the occipital lobe can. It can be enlarged by what is taught to the human being through the right education. It is therefore possible, by means of suitable education, to help a human being who has too short an occipital lobe as a result of the previous incarnation. By educating such a person properly, we make the etheric part of the occipital lobe larger, and the person in question can thereby be saved from criminality. But now, given the fact that we find an occipital lobe that is too short in those who have become criminals, we would also have to do the opposite experiment. We would have to dissect normal people and prove that they all had normally developed occipital lobes. And in doing so, we might discover that even in normally developed people, it happens that they have an occipital lobe that is too small, but they nevertheless have not become criminals, because the etheric occipital lobe has become larger through appropriate education. Ethical education, then, adds to the etheric, not the physical constitution. However, education must be organized in such a way that it conforms with spiritual laws. If you take what has been developed as a principle of education in the small publication titled Educating Children Today, you will find that the principles of development from 1 7 years to the next 7 years were followed. When you start to take these laws and translate them into appropriate action, you are intervening more deeply than with the purely rationalistic educational methods that have been commonplace for a long time. Nor do we get any further with what has emerged as Frobelism. With all the educational methods that are used today, you only approach the I. And for as long as you only approach the I, you can't do anything. The occipital lobe remains too small. But if you eavesdrop on the secrets of spiritual existence and turn them into educational measures, you will enter the etheric body. Then you really make the etheric body normal. That is, you gain powerful concepts with spiritual science, concepts that really have a power over the human being, that can change them. If you take the concepts that can be obtained today, be it on the one hand from the observation of the sensory world of perception, be it on the other hand from the abstract talk that comes only from the eye, you get no educational principles and also no principles for social life that really impinge on the human being. The concepts remain powerless. You can search through whole libraries, and there is plenty written about education. But all of that represents a desire to regulate out of the eye, no matter whether you think you are educating more theoretically or otherwise. For as long as nothing is learned from the mystery of human nature and the spiritual principles of education, and thereby made effective into the etheric body, the concepts remain powerless against what grows up in the human being. But if we do so, we also approach with such concepts, as they grow more powerful, what develops and grows in the world, so that we practically incorporate nothing theoretical. If we go from philosophical to imaginative concepts, as spiritual science does, and if we go from sensory perception to metamorphosing perception, we will make our principles more closely related to the spiritual, and then we will obtain corresponding measures and principles from spiritual science. From what I have said, you can see how right, how necessary it is in our time, after the world has been reduced by centuries of development to just sensory perception, and has thus been pushed back to just comprehension in the eye, how necessary it is to bring outer perception and inner soul life closer together again, both for reflection and for practical life. With spiritual science, we gain powerful concepts that intervene in life, concepts that really have something to do with life. Such concepts as those of Eucken's philosophy never intervene in real life. With spiritual science, we grasp what is real. We grasp it where it is more real than sensory perception. When we approach what is real with our ordinary concepts, with ordinary sensory perception, we look at what is on the surface. We look with our sensory tools. We look, for example, at the mountain with its flora. And now there are these two kinds of people. Some look at the mountain with its plant world and forget themselves, heckle. Others don't look at the outside world at all, but only ramble on in concepts and stare into the void. Thus, philosophy becomes empty, Eucken's philosophy. Spiritual science approaches what is real with metamorphosing perception, and thereby looks at something that does not express itself on the surface, but something that lies beneath. But also, when it looks at the human being, it proceeds from simple sensory perception of the physical sense organs, back to metamorphosing perception, etheric body, and from the mere philosophical concept to imaginative conception. And as a result has something like a subterranean channel between simple sensory perception, physical sense organs, and the simple philosophical concept, I capital. Now, you will also understand that a bleak worldview must come about if spiritual science does not spread. For philosophy will, of course, become quite impotent with its concepts in relation to the human being. It will not be believed, something that is already happening. After all, there is no denying sensory perception. It will be less and less possible to deny it. So it is natural that the materialistic worldview will say, how can you help becoming a criminal? How can you help having an occipital lobe that is too short? Just think what this means for the concept of responsibility and for legal concepts. We have to look at this perspective. It is cowardly not to look at it. There is, however, a possibility of going beyond this, if the etheric body is worked on from within through appropriately good education, so that the etheric occipital lobe is developed as a result. Such education, however, must be an education of the heart and of love, as has been shown in title Educating Children Today. When you realize this, then you say to yourself, certainly such a person with an occipital lobe that is too short will walk around all their life with the occipital lobe shortened and will experience temptation. But through the development of the etheric occipital lobe, they will always be able to find the necessary balance. In this way, spiritual science will become a major factor when those who only know the achievements of the materialistic worldview knock at the door of spiritual science. Secondly, I would like to show you another thing that can be taken from the soul life. Especially in our time today, we have the opportunity to see that feelings can spread through entire national communities, for example, feelings of hatred. Now, someone who still holds a naive worldview, when asked, "Why do you hate?" naturally, they don't know exactly why something is hateful, because they still have the naive worldview. They will perhaps say, "I hate because I find it hateful." Now today there is a psychological worldview that has gone beyond such naivete, that knows something more than that you hate something because it is hateful. Just as the criminal anthropologist knows more than the person who believed that someone became a criminal because he was a bad fellow and didn't get any better. Because the criminal anthropologist knows that the subject has an occipital lobe that is too small. And so that is also a naive judgment when you say, "I hate this or that because it is hateful." Well, here too some people have already come to a correct judgment. Anyone who takes a closer look at human nature sees how the feelings that are developed in the soul belong to the tools, to the conditions of life of the soul. And if we do not look at the world of the soul naively, but with real observation of the facts today, we arrive at the conclusion that there is latently stored up in the human being, without it becoming visible, a certain quantum of the need to hate. They must hate. And when so much hatred has accumulated that the barrel overflows, so to speak, they seek an object for their power of hatred. Now consider the way in which a person arrives at a worldview. We endeavor to show how we should arrive at a spiritual, scientific worldview in an objective way. But this is not always how people arrive at a spiritual, scientific worldview, nor at a materialistic worldview. But it happens because they are emotionally predestined to do so. What logically speaks in favor of a worldview only takes second or even third place. Go, for example, to the meetings of communists or materialists and examine what they put forward to logically substantiate their worldview. Then you can notice that not their logic but their feeling is predestined for it. And so it is also with the spiritual scientific worldview. Perhaps you have the mystical worldview out of your feelings because it is more comfortable for you than a materialistic worldview. The emotional, the affective factor plays an enormous role here. It is the same with hatred toward the outside world. When a person hates something, the psychologist will not ask, "What is the object like?" But they will ask, "What is the person like?" The need to hate is within them, and the object then arises of its own accord. They must hate, as they must eat at certain times. This is an insight that contemporary psychology has already reached. I have in my hand an issue of the journal titled Die Zukunft, The Future, from 25 September 1915, in which there is an essay by Franz Blei entitled Wahrheiten, Truths. Something along the lines of what I have just said is set out there. Then it explains what Avenarius, Franz Blei is a student of Avenarius, established with his empirical critical philosophy. This is summarized in individual sentences, and in these sentences you will find very nicely expressed what today can already be understood as psychological research results. Quote, pure feelings are to be theoretically assumed as pre-existent to feelings freighted with ideational components and cannot be experienced. In practice, we do not know any feeling that does not have an ideational component. Close quote. This sentence does not exactly relate to what we need, so let us not dwell on the sentence. It is not necessary for us to dissect it, otherwise we would have to examine the concepts that have been used. But another sentence may well be more important for us, namely that, quote, pure ideas must be theoretically assumed as pre-existent to humanly conceived ideas and cannot be purely experienced. In practice, we know of no idea, thought, image, that has not already served as a component for a feeling. Close quote. So, when an idea arises in us, we have to ask ourselves, what feeling has prompted this idea in us? In one person, the idea arises. The world is separable into atoms. What feeling prompted them? In another person, the idea arises. The world has a hierarchy, a stepladder. What feeling prompted them? So the component of feeling is in all of it. And if someone is filled with hate, what is the feeling that prompts them? Bly says, quote, it is not ideas that call forth feelings, but pure feelings seize upon ideas that can satisfy these feelings. Close quote. For example, the social democrat hates the bourgeois person. They hate them because a quantum of hatred is necessary for them, and they direct it toward the bourgeois person. Or the anti-Semite needs hatred, and the Jews present themselves for this purpose. Franz Bly says in point 8, quote, it is not the truth of an idea in itself that determines its acceptance by people, but its affective content, close quote. So you see, he already knows that too. You do not become a materialistic monist because you see the truth, but because you are predestined for it by your feeling. And you do not become a spiritualist because it is true, but because you are predestined for it by your feeling. This essay goes on to say, quote, ideas are accepted whose probability is zero. Others again, together with and at the same time as those that are the opposite of the former. Consider the manifold nature of thou shalt not kill. Here only the believer is permitted an objection to which Hegel once gave the expression of the, quote, deviousness of the idea, which makes use of our passion for its realization, in that people think they are working for themselves, while in reality they are doing it for the world spirit. The Christian believer speaks of the inscrutability of God's ways, close quote. So the whole essay is about it not being the ideas, the so-called truths that take hold of people, but the emotional content. Anyone who looks at the world today as it has gradually developed will find this quite correct, and it is very significant that a school of philosophers, like that of Avenarius, has come to realize that the social democrat does not hate the bourgeois because they find them hateful, but because they themselves need a certain quantum of hate. So Avenarius's school of philosophy has already arrived at that today. But let us consider what in turn the social consequence of this is. If you put yourself in the position, and we might say that this position, if you still have any real feeling at all, must turn into the most bitter pill for the soul, of taking these things seriously as truths, you will have to say to yourself, truth no longer decides anything, but the affects decide. I am indeed led into a worldview, but only because I do not know the truth. This then leads into absolute desolation. There is no escape. Just as in criminal anthropology, there is no escape from admitting that an occipital lobe that is too short makes a criminal, so in external psychology, there is no escape from the fact that people are driven by their affects to what they call truth. Friedrich Nietzsche most clearly, most significantly, and most plausibly tried to present this in a great many variants in his worldview. This underlies the whole of Nietzscheanism. I have cited the passage myself in my book titled Friedrich Nietzsche, Ein Kämpfer gegen seine Zeit. It is about the question, what is truth? And because Nietzsche did not accept the correctness of this proposition because of the truth, but rejected it because of the whole preparation of human subjectivity, that is why Nietzsche wanted to put an end to the fantasy of the will to truth, that is also to Christianity. That is why he wrote the Antichrist title. The next was to be titled The Immoralists, and the whole was then to be titled The Will to Power. Desolation, absolute nihilism, is what precisely such schools of philosophy lead to, with their realization that whoever is predisposed to believe that they can best come into a relationship with the world by adhering to matter becomes a materialist, and anyone who believes that they live by dependence on the spiritual world becomes a spiritualist out of their affect. Well, my dear friends, you need only take one thing to counter this. You need only open the last chapter of title Theosophy, where the path to knowledge is described, and take the fact from which it starts. For the start is not made by assuming that you should ruminate logically in order to arrive at these truths, but by assuming that it is necessary to form and shape the whole affective world of the human being, the direction of feeling, in a certain way. It deals with what lies at the heart of the search for truth. It tackles what psychology points to, but doesn't know what to do with. Why do we not refute materialism with logical reasons? Why do we not justify spiritualism with logical reasons? Because none of this means anything. On the contrary, something else needs to be shown. It needs to be shown you have to do this and this with your affects, so that you are no longer guided by the subjective, but, and there's a gap in the text. Take this chapter of title, Theosophy, and you will see that everything depends on objectifying the affective life. And then you can see how this intervenes in the dead end of the modern worldview. Bracket, the final sentences are no longer decipherable in the shorthand note. Close bracket, and that is the end of Lecture 10.